Welcome to Sidactic. I am Dr. O'Leary, and today I've been enjoying watching the snow melt after a week of sledding and hot chocolate. In this podcast, I explore topics in psychiatry and neuroscience. I am in the last 6 months of my 4-year psychiatry residency, after which, well, people will still call me doctor, but I'll have a few more letters after my name. I typically imagine that medical students, psychiatry residents, and full-grown psychiatrists are my target audience, but all are welcome. I produce this podcast all by myself in my free time, so be aware that the content is generated from my brain and what I have read, and it's not moderated or fact-checked or approved by anyone else. Everything here is my opinion, right or wrong, for better or for worse, until I change my mind. Recently, I've realized that of the 49 full episodes that I have produced, I have neglected to touch much on personality disorders. Part of this has been unintentionally intentional. I mean, these diagnoses can be controversial, and the use of them has a mottled history in psychiatry. I mean, as little as 30 years ago, a diagnosis of a personality disorder in a military member with post-traumatic stress disorder would result in them being discharged from the military without compensation or even an evaluation for disability. Most likely, what they were calling a personality disorder was just features of post-traumatic stress disorder. Now, this has since been changed, but the damage done in the past is not just limited to members of the military. I mean, anyone not conforming to society's expectations, if they found themselves in front of a psychiatrist and weren't just obviously psychotic, were pretty likely to get a diagnosis of a personality disorder. I've worked with psychiatrists who don't have problems diagnosing psychotic people with personality disorders, having never seen them not psychotic. With regard to PTSD, there are over 600,000 permutations of the DSM criteria that can result in a diagnosis of PTSD, and many of the criteria might mimic those of certain personality disorders. In addition, complex PTSD, also called developmental trauma disorder, can result in maladaptive personality features, especially if a child grows up in an unpredictable or abusive environment. I'm reminded of an episode of Hardcore History, which is a podcast by Dan Carlin, where he explored the conjecture that potentially for the majority of human history, most people had personalities that were molded by traumatic experiences throughout their childhood. It is entirely possible that during many or most periods in the past, everyone had complex PTSD. Today, though, I'm not going into too much detail about PTSD or how it can be confused with a personality disorder. Instead, I want to discuss how the criteria we have been using in the past to diagnose personality disorders have failed us, and what the writers of the DSM are trying to do about that. There was an article in Current Psychiatry Reports in 2019 by Zimmerman et al. That talked about the DSM's attempts to change how we think about personality disorders. They said this, quote, "The assumption that personality disorders are categories is incompatible with most available evidence. The threshold for defining the presence of a personality disorder are largely arbitrary, and the assignment of individual personality disorder symptoms to specific disorders does not correspond to their empirical covariation," unquote. Now, that is a pretty fancy way of saying that what we have been doing is not very reliable or even valid. So to address this issue, the DSM proposed a personality model that was based on personality constructs that have come in the past. The most obvious of these is the five-factor model, also called the Big Five. It consisted of neuroticism, extroversion, openness, agreeableness, and conscientiousness. But another way to look at this group of factors is to look at it with opposing traits. For example, neuroticism could be characterized as affect instability versus stability. Extroversion can be contrasted with introversion. Openness versus closedness or protectiveness. Agreeableness versus antagonism. And conscientiousness could be seen as, well, thoughtfulness or constraint versus disinhibition. Each of the big five has many dimensions. The DSM has adapted these dimensions and named them according to what psychiatrists might find clinically useful. The DSM big five are negative affectivity versus emotional stability, detachment versus extroversion, antagonism versus agreeableness, disinhibition versus conscientiousness, and psychoticism versus lucidity. The last, psychoticism, is an approximation of unconventionality, where a person just does strange, odd, or abnormal things, or thinks in a way that is abnormal, compared with their cultural peers. Now, being unconventional doesn't necessarily correlate with psychoticism. I mean, an unconventional person may be odd due to the fact that, well, they're so much more intelligent than their peers. Psychoticism is more related to a failure of discriminatory intellect than a superior intellect. Psychoticism is associated with looseness of associations and magical thinking. These things are unconventional, but in a more disorganized way. One of the things that defines personality features is that they tend to be relatively stable over time, but I should point out that some of them are stably unstable, which means that their pathological variant only presents itself under certain conditions. So think about someone whose mood is highly reactive to stress, or who is detached only around strangers, but really highly extroverted when they're around trusted people. Before I go on, I don't want the listener to get the impression that these opposing states of any personality feature are meant to be some kind of like good versus bad trait dichotomy. For example, antagonism versus agreeableness isn't necessarily a good versus bad trait. Instead, any direction of the trait can be pathological. Too much openness can result in a person being frequently taken advantage of or easily manipulated. An impervious affect will hamper a person's ability to relate to other human beings. Being too conscientious or thoughtful might result in difficulty making decisions. The DSM-5 encourages psychiatrists to start considering all of these factors along with the global functioning of an individual, and to build an inventory for any patient who's having some dysfunction related to their personality. They propose a personality disorder trait-specified diagnostic criteria in order to accommodate this new type of formulation. Criterion A considers personality functioning, while Criterion B catalogs which of those big five factors are notably deranged. Now, there's a table on page 775 of the DSM-5 that proposed a kind of rubric for identifying and rating Criterion A, the level of personality functioning. Without any notable dysfunction, gaining a full catalog of Criteria B would really be an exercise in curiosity more than a clinically relevant task, because if you don't have any dysfunction, we don't really need to go into why you don't have dysfunction. Personality function, according to the DSM, is divided into how someone operates internally and how someone deals with others in interpersonal interactions. The internal self functions are divided into identity and self-direction. The interpersonal functions are divided into empathy and intimacy. I'm going to start with identity. Identity is described as whether someone is aware of their own unique identity and has a realistic view of themselves. You also have to assess the level of self-esteem and control over emotions. Now, on the extreme end of a pathological self-concept, a patient is almost entirely externally focused. They feel no ability to direct their own actions. They rely on others for assessments of themselves, or they have delusional or unrealistic self-appraisals. Patients with severe identity disturbances also tend to lack the ability to control their own emotions, and they attribute their emotions entirely to their current circumstances. So without a sense of self, the only other option that they have is to blame someone else, or to blame something else. The next facet of functioning is called self-direction. So this describes the ability of a patient to make and to meet goals, to adapt their behaviors to a range of new contexts, and apply socially appropriate standards in those contexts, and also to have a meaningful internal dialogue regarding one's own cognitive abilities and emotional control. So on the extreme pathological end of this, a person may have none or incoherent or just completely unrealistic goals. They might act on thoughts with little ability to restrain themselves. They might be unable to consistently apply reasonable, situationally appropriate standards to their own actions. So someone without the ability for adaptive self-direction is motivated almost entirely by their reactions to their external environment or their current emotional state. So those are the self criteria that we talk about. The interpersonal criteria are empathy and intimacy. I'm going to start with empathy, and I'm going to admit that empathy versus sympathy is kind of hard for me to define, and I've encountered dozens of permutations of the difference between the two of those. So I've decided just not to care which word is used and just try to figure out what someone is trying to get at by the context. According to the DSM, empathy on the personality functional rating scale refers to someone's ability to relate to others and consider them as autonomous beings with their own unique feelings and perspectives. Then those can be either similar to their own or different. Someone with high-functioning empathy will, for example, be able to consider that they should not necessarily do unto others as they would have done unto themselves, but instead to do unto others as others would want them to do. An extreme lack of empathy entails the inability to consider the internal states of others and may result in a patient just being either confused or oblivious to other people's motivations or their emotions. Intimacy requires at least some level of empathy, just as self-direction requires some level of identity. Someone with normally functioning intimacy both desires and is able to maintain close relationships with others that are mutually beneficial. The relationship's able to grow and develop as individuals change. Extremely dysfunctional intimacy is characterized by relationships being almost entirely transactional. One may view others as either a means to gain pleasure or pain, and one may have no desire at all for personal interactions. So for each of these categories, identity, self-direction, empathy, and intimacy, the DSM proposes a scale from 0 to 4, where 0 is little to no impairment, and 4 is extreme impairment. Because there are 5 levels, this scale acts kind of like a Likert scale, where higher scores indicate more impairment. As I mentioned earlier, these dimensions do not, on the surface, appear to be independent of each other. So scores on identity, for example, will likely correlate with scores on self-direction. I think the most important part of using a dimensional scale is not the final score, but the particular observations or assessments that resulted in that score. And it also provides us with a numerical way to assess whether or not someone meets criteria A instead of, well, just a hunch that they do. It's unclear whether someone should apply the 0 to 4 scale for each level of impairment separately, like for identity, for self-direction, for empathy, and for intimacy, or just assign a single value for all four. Now, if you base it on all of the traits at the same time, do you calculate like an average of what you would have given for each trait? Or do you just pick the most severe rating you gave and then use that as your level? Another hole in the proposed diagnostic process is the failure to incorporate Bayesian statistical methods. But this is really true for everything in the DSM. And you will hear me complaining about this a lot, and I don't want to get too off track here, but I think it's important to keep saying this over and over and over again. So the rates of false positives and negatives can be really attenuated if we focus more research on estimating likelihood ratios from our tests and reliable prior probabilities that a particular patient will have the disease. But I digress. There are so many possible combinations of traits in the DSM that the normal interview psychiatrists conduct is really not likely to do more than identify the need to identify more factors. But once a suspicion of dysfunction is established, in order to get reliable and valid information from a patient about the domains of their dysfunction, psychological testing is probably the best option. Psychiatrists may be able to conduct some of these instruments, but to do a good job, we would need more training than we typically get currently. The various measures of inter-rater reliability for criterion A or B show only moderate levels of agreement at best, and this is considered acceptable. But I would rather something be more than just acceptable. That sounds like something I would tell my son for how well he cleaned the kitchen floor. There are numerous proposed scales or inventories that can be used, and I'm not going to discuss most of them here. If you want the nitty-gritty on that, go see that Zimmerman 2019 paper I referenced earlier. The references themselves are going to be either in the transcript available at sidactic.buzzsprout.com or in any kind of show notes or descriptions of the episode. So look in those places. I will mention one, the personality inventory for DSM-5 or the PID-5. And it has various versions based on who is doing the assessment, like self-assessment or a collateral informant or the physician. And it was specifically designed to assess these DSM criteria. I have so far discussed in a little bit of detail criterion A, which gives us a determination of whether or not someone is dysfunctional. But criterion B, which is an inventory of those big five domains I mentioned earlier, tells us what way someone is particularly dysfunctional, what part of their personality is contributing to their dysfunction. So as a reminder, these big five in the DSM are labeled negative affectivity, detachment, antagonism, disinhibition, and psychoticism. And each of these has various numbers of subdimensions, which they call facets, that can describe it. The facets in each domain can be shared among different domains. For example, depressivity and restricted affectivity are present in the negative affectivity and the detachment domains. Hostility is present in the negative affectivity and antagonism domains. Some facets have quite a diversity of domains that don't, on the surface, seem that related to each other. Negative affectivity, for example, could be described in terms of how depressive someone is prone to be, but also how anxious and worried someone is, or how easy it is to disturb their emotions, how reactive their emotions are, or how submissive they are, or how suspicious of others they are, or how hostile toward others they are. And inexplicably, it also encompasses the catatonic sign perseveration. That's not to be confused with rumination, but instead refers to temporally correlated repeated behaviors that either have no goal, are attempting to accomplish an inappropriate or unattainable goal, or are repeated despite the fact that they could not possibly accomplish a goal. All these things are very different, and this variability in what they call negative affectivity confounds me a little. If I were to discuss each of these domains and their facets in a lot of detail, I would put you to sleep pretty fast. You can read the DSM or kind of Google them if you want. What I think is important to note is that these domains were chosen as a way to assess psychopathology, so they're giving a limited picture of the fullness of any particular person's personality or their cognitive, emotional, and behavioral tendencies, because they're only really looking for psychopathology. Also, even though these dimensions have been shown to be valid across different cultures, that doesn't mean that the assessment of these dimensions will be reliable cross-culturally. Say the psychiatrist is from a different culture than the patient. So psychiatrists and psychologists should take great care when they make judgments about what is dysfunctional versus what is within the normal limits for a particular culture. Now, I'm considering in the future exploring these domains in more depth and relating them to our already existing personality disorders. One of these is borderline personality disorder, and it is a bane of the diagnostic process because it has a lot of comorbidities, especially with trauma disorders and affective disorders and disturbances of perception. Borderline personality disorder is the most diagnosed personality disorder, but this is kind of due in part to the fact that schizoid, schizotypal, paranoid, avoidant, antisocial, or like obsessive compulsive personalities are really unlikely to voluntarily present to a psychiatrist, whereas borderline traits almost guarantee that at some point, the person who has these will find themselves in a psychiatrist's office and potentially be placed on numerous medications. Now, cross your fingers that I don't get too distracted by some other topic before putting these episodes together. If I do get distracted, hopefully it will be with maybe the neurological correlates of personalities. Thank you for listening. Until next time, and even after, I am Dr. O, and this has been an episode of Psydactic.